an all-new episode of the Jeremy White Podcast, Tuesday at noon, available wherever you stream. Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now. Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
Well, let's get right into this, and let's talk about this big career-spanning box set out on October 15th, previously unreleased tracks, and it's like 43 CDs. This thing is absolutely ridiculous. Let's welcome the original member of Judas Priest, Mr. Ian Hill. There he is, everybody.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Yes.
And by the way, when we say 42 CDs ridiculous, we mean ridiculously good, because
yes,
it is
amazing. I mean, you're giving Gene Simmons a run for his money at this point with this box set.
Well, thanks for that.
Yeah. Thank you. So talk to me about this, because 42 CDs is a monster box set, which comes with a monster price tag. Why not sort of divide this into 10 smaller releases or some 5 smaller releases? What was the decision in saying, listen, we're just going to give you everything here. Enjoy.
I think it's, I don't know. The marketing side of thing, that sort of comes from the label anyway, for the most part. But people can always go and buy most of the stuff anyway in singular units. But I don't know. Like you say, it's such an impressive thing, like a box set, and the I don't know, the working brief is just throw everything at it, whatever we've got, throw at this box set.
Right.
And we were lucky, you know, because we thought we'd already exhausted the vaults. We thought it had all gone, you know, with previous box sets and special releases and things. And suddenly all this other stuff starts coming out of the woodwork, you know, it's somebody's loft or the back of a cupboard. Right. Yeah, and people started to, you know, discover all this old unreleased stuff. And we gave it to our long-suffering producer, Tom Allen, to go through. I mean, he knows more about the band than anybody, you know, to give it whether it was safe for public consumption, that sort of thing. And yeah, he passed it all. He might have tweaked the sounds of it, but that's all he could do. A lot of the material, a lot of the more obscure stuff anyway, was just on basic 2-track master. So
right,
he couldn't mix it, you know. He just had to tweak the knobs and try and make it sound a little bit better.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. It seems like, you know, that you guys just had a bunch of cassette tapes from like Soundboard, and you pass it off to Tom and said, here, try and EQ this. Make it sound a little bit better than, you know.
Yeah, there you go. Yep, you're on the magic powder on it.
Let me ask you this. Since you were the originator, you were the guy at the beginning of Priest, you went through different lineup changes, different singers, you know, until you got to Rob. When did you sort of decide or figure out, go, yeah, this is the lineup, you know, when you had Al and we had the other guys and you go, we need a different guitarist. When did you sort of realize that, yeah, this lineup is the one that's going to move forward?
I don't think we did. Excuse me, my dog going off his head out of it.
Oh, that's okay.
That's my dog, I'm sorry.
Mitch has got two hiding behind him, too.
I got two right here that will probably bark as soon as somebody opens a door, so don't worry.
what was I saying? It's born out of necessity. I've been going right back to the very early days when sort of Ken and myself and a drummer called John Ellis. And Al Atkins later joined that, and we inherited the name Judas Priest from Alan, who was a member of the original Judas Priest from the year before. There's that watershed moment. I mean, we'd got jobs and things, and on a local scale, it was great. You could come out of work, get cleaned up, make it to the show, come back and get back to work in comparatively good shape the next day. But suddenly you start to get offers coming from 200-300 miles away, you know, on a Wednesday night, and you can't do that sort of thing if you've got a job. So we had to make a decision of whether we're going to make a go of it or whether just to stay local. And the three of us, Al and Ken and myself, said, okay, we'll knock our jobs on the head and make a go. But John, he got a decent job, you know. And it's not the sort of thing that he was going to risk. Not that much stage.
Right. What did John?
We weren't making a great deal of money out of it.
Yeah.
What job did John Perry get that he decided he's not going to stick with Judas Priest?
Oh, sorry, John Ellis. What?
John Perry, well, John Perry, or what did John, what job did John get where he said, or he John was, Ellis on drums?
He'd got an apprenticeship at a company in West Bromwich called Kenrick and Jefferson's. And they were a huge printing firm, amongst other things. Like they were manufacturers. They were one of the biggest sort of manufacturers in the area. And it was one of those things where there's a decent job at the end of the apprenticeship.
Right.
Al, myself, and Ken were doing the kind of things that you could pick up any time, you know, so we hadn't got anything to lose, really.
Well, you weren't like a paper boy or something, were you?
No, I worked in the West Bromwich is famous for springs, huge lorry springs and things like that.
Right.
And I worked at a firm that specialized in repairing them.
Well, I mean, and, you know, to be fair, I mean, like the pub in Leeds isn't paying as much as an apprenticeship, so probably it was a good decision on his part.
That's yeah. right, yeah. So, and of course, then it comes around and replaced. Oh, it was Alan Moore did the first stint with the band, replaced John, and he only stayed with us for a matter of a couple of months.
Yep.
And then he went off to join a band called Sundance, who they had got a record contract already then, you know, so who could blame him for that? Mm-hmm. And then Chris Campbell came along, and he stayed with us right up until when Alan's wife got pregnant, and suddenly he had to go and get a real job because he needed to finance the family, you know.
Right.
So Alan went, and Chris left with him. And we didn't know it then, but it was probably one of the most fortuitous exits from the band because enter Rob Halford and John Hinch, you know.
Right.
And most of the rest, you know. But then, of course, Glenn joins. It was a suggestion from our first record company, Gull Records, that, it wouldn't be safe. It would be great with either another musician. They suggested a sax player. I said, no, that ain't going to happen.
Oh, my God.
Either a keyboard player or another guitarist, you know. And then Glenn came along and we asked him to join. And that was it then. We got the trademark lineup after that. We weren't going to do anything.
Yeah.
Anything that did a majorly different than that, you know. So that's the way we stayed.
Did Glenn have to audition or, like, well, you know, when he came in, like, what was it about Glenn's guitar playing that you just said, ah, yeah, he's the guy.
Yeah, Glenn played with a band called Flying Hat Band. And we'd done a couple of gigs with them, you know, over the previous couple of years or so. And we knew he was a great guitarist, you know, from then. And we just happened to see him in a music shop in Birmingham. And I asked him if he'd be interested. And, yeah, he was keen to join, you know.
Nice.
We had got a record contract by then, you know, because it was them that were suggesting the, you know, the extra guitarist, the extra musician. Mm. And Flying Hat Band still hadn't got, they were still searching for a record company.
Flying Hat Band.
I suppose that was a bit of a sweetener for Glenn.
He
agreed to join.
What I find interesting about the genesis of Judas Priest and Scorpions is that both bands went through like 14 drummers before they actually got to their lineup. What was it about drummers in Europe that just couldn't be counted on, that you had to keep replacing them?
I don't know.
I think Spinal Tap even made it, you know, was joking about that in their movie, because they released, they replaced their drummer like after like every album or something. One drummer like just like randomly combusted in the middle of a show. Yeah. Like, just, you know.
Let me get to the Tim Ripper.
A few parallels there.
Yeah.
This box set finally has the Tim Ripper Owen stuff. It has been somewhat difficult to find on the streaming services and somewhat difficult to find in other official channels. But here it is. Talk to me about their inclusions and the part they play in the band's history. Because, you know, like it or lump it, Jugulator, Live Meltdown, Demolition, Live in London. It's a great continuation of the band.
There's some great material on those two albums.
Of course.
There really is.
Yes.
But there's different record companies there as well, different distributors. So there's contractual problems there, which is why we couldn't, you know, we couldn't release it all together before, you know. But this time around, the powers that be came to an agreement and let it out, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a low point for the band in one way. Robert left, we weren't playing to the large audiences anymore. But like I say, musically, there was some excellent stuff on both of those albums. Demolition in particular is one of my favourite albums, Demolition. There's some tremendous stuff on there, you know. But then again,
the shows were great.
To come back to the band, and that was, you know, I mean, even Tim could see the sense of that. Yeah. Letting him back in, we're all fans of the band, you know. But he could see that was the right way to go.
But I got a chance to see Judas Priest with that lineup at the Hampton Casino Ballroom in New Hampshire. And it was one of the greatest shows ever. I mean, here you have Judas Priest in your face with like 2,000 other fans. It was brilliant. And the lineup was brilliant. I mean, it was a great Judas Priest show. So, you know, can't complain.
No, we would. Yeah, I mean, all the elements were still there, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the four of us were still there. But, you know, Glenn, Ken, Scott, myself, and a great vocalist. Tim has a tremendous voice, you know. He really does. So all the elements for a great pre-show were there all along, you know.
I got a question for you. I'm just really curious about this because Painkiller is one of my favorite albums of all time, and it was the first record with Scott Travis on drums. Does he come in and play that opening, the Painkiller, as his audition? Like, how did that all happen? And how did you decide like to pick Scott to be the new man behind the Skins?
We'd known Scott for some time. He played with a band called Racer X, and Rob was familiar with him. He knew the other guys for some time. That was it. I mean, Rob knew that he was a great drummer, you know.
Yeah,
and he was one of the. I think even Glenn Cornick. Remember Glenn Cornick from not Glenn Cornick, Clive Bunker, from Jethro Tull. He was up for the job as well. Yeah, I know. but Scott just about blew everybody away. We rented a big villa in Spain in the middle of nowhere. And got Scott over there, and we'd already written most of Painkiller anyway, and just started working it out, and he handled it. It was brilliant, and the opening to Painkiller, he'd probably been practicing that for the rest of the early part of his career. It worked perfectly, you know.
It was probably his warm-up drill.
I
said it was probably his warm-up drill or something.
Yeah, who knows?
It's so
anyway, he came out with that, and the rest is history. He's a tremendous drummer, you know, really is. He's a terrific guy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And he's an incredibly nice guy, too, having met him a bunch of times. Just super nice. Well, let me get you over to Angel of Retribution, which is also on the box set. It is the reunion album. It is the one where Rob comes back. I remember at the time a lot of talk in the media and a lot of this, and people were like, oh, is it going to be good? Is it blah, 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 blah? And it just blew everybody away. What kind of pressure were you facing to have a great album? Because in a sense, if it was a dud, it might have stopped the reunion and what you're doing dead in the tracks. But instead, everybody went, whoa, best album of 2005.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. Yeah, but I mean, when we're running through songs and getting the idea, I mean, Ken, Glenn and Rob know more than I do because they're the songwriters. But if it ain't quality, it doesn't get passed anyway, you know. So by the time we got into the studio, we knew we'd got some good material, and we put it down really well, you know. Roy Z did the production on that one, did a tremendous job, and. And yeah, I mean, we carried on. We couldn't carry on from Demolition, really. That had taken, those two albums had taken a little bit of a different track. They were a much harder, much rawer sort of direction. So we sort of went back to Painkiller, sort of imagined where we'd be if we were doing the next album from there, you know.
Mm.
And that was a very loose working idea, you know. And I just basically got it. We've been really lucky, you know. I mean, we do what we want, basically. And we've been very, very lucky in as much as the fans have gone along with it, you know, and they've liked it too. So we are lucky in that respect. We've never sort of thought, oh, yeah, the fans are going to expect this and we can't do that because the fans don't want to do it, you know.
Right.
We just got on and done it and they've gone along with it. And I feel extremely privileged to be able to get away with stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's the funny thing, though. It's like fans can be the worst in that way because it's like, you know, you think you're doing something. It's like, oh, the fans are going to love this. And then you put it on and you're like, oh, what is this shit, you know? And then you can't really explore yourself. You're like, well, we just want to have fun and put out this record. And it's like, there's just so much. Do you still feel that pressure, like when you're putting stuff out of like, oh, are the fans going to like this? Or are you at the point, you know, 50 years later, like, you know what, we're just doing this to have fun. And whether people like it or not, whatever, at least we're doing it and we're getting a kick out of it.
Yeah. Well, I think I said earlier, we're all fans of the band.
Right. Yeah.
And I think if we're pleasing ourselves, we're pretty much pleasing the fans as well, you know. Mm-hmm. So as long as it passes that sort of quality yardstick, we're onto something good generally.
Yeah, yeah. Fans are so annoying. They'll be like, oh, every album sounds the same, and then you do something different, they go, oh, it doesn't sound like the other. And you're just like,
yeah, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, look, like, I mean, at the end of the day, you even look at this big box set. It's like, you know, with all the live stuff, people are like, oh, but they don't have Electric Eye from Atlanta 1984. Like, you know, where's that?
So. I know. But, you know, and then we can talk about Nostradamus too. Let me just quickly take you over to the one album that I love that seems to be the one that everybody debates. And it's of course, Turbo Lover. I mean,
yeah,
you're love coming it. To Montreal here later this year on your tour. And I keep thinking, what are the odds of them playing Parental Guidance? I love that fucking song. Please play it. But
yeah.
Do you look back at that album with pride or regret that you go, well, we sort of followed the Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, glammy stuff? Or do you just say, listen, it's a great album. Leave me alone.
Yeah, I think it was one of the albums where we were not worried, but a little bit concerned, shall I say, because of we'd reached a level there with Defenders of the Faith. Mm-hmm. And you reach pretty much the end of that road, and we've always tried to do something better, what we consider to be better, mm-hmm. and take a step forward with each album. And it would have been very, very difficult to take another step in that direction from that album, you know.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite. It is, in fact, my favorite album, you know, because of that.
Yeah.
Turbo was your favorite or Defenders?
Defenders.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorites, if not the favorite, but. We got First Refusal on these guitar synthesizers by Roland,
right.
And we thought, well, maybe this is the next step, you know,
right?
And probably went a bit over the top with it, but that was the basic idea, you know, just to take that next step forward and make things a little bit different.
But you're right, it
lost us some fans. It did lose us some fans. Yeah. On the other hand, it gained us new ones, you know.
But what was the influence there? I mean, like, you know, records like Pyromania had just come out and, you know. Is that you, Mitch? Is that you? It's Rob Halford calling right now saying, stop talking shit about Turbo. But no, talking about Turbo, it's like, you know, you guys go down to Compass Point, you know, in the Bahamas. You're not, you know, necessarily, it's almost like a vacation, staycation, workcation, you know. What was the influence behind that record? I mean, going to the synthesizer guitars and all that stuff, like, you know, was it really influence from the record label, or were you guys just saying, you know what, like I said, you know, let's have some fun?
It was basically that, like I say, we had first refusal on those synthesizers. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody else was using, or not many people were using them at the time. And we were looking, like I say, for something a little bit different, a little bit new, another step forward. And that was a basic thought behind all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I went ahead with it. And we were a little bit anxious about it, whether it was going to be received by everybody or not. But like I say, in the end, I mean, I look back on it now. I mean, it doesn't seem as radical as it did then. Yeah. but at the time, it did seem a huge step out of line, you know.
Mm. Well, just remember on November 4th in Laval, Quebec, parental guidance. Just throw that in there. Just for me. Just for me. Because
I love that.
Let me ask you this. We're recording this on August 26th. And on August 26th, 2004, Rob subbed for Ozzy on their on the Black Sabbath show in Camden, New Jersey. So 17 years to the day. What was that like for you? I mean, he had done a couple of shows back in the 90s, but what was that sort of day where the camp's going, oh my God, Ozzy's not going to sing, and they come to Rob? Just sort of the going on backstage where the decision was made and you went, oh yeah, our boy's going to go sing. Okay, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, it was a hero moment, wasn't it? You know, the guy on the black hat rides up and saves the day.
Yes, and it sounds great.
It's one of those things, you know, and Rob was familiar at least with most of the Sabbath stuff, although that set list they happened to be playing. And he went on and nailed it, you know, and then he came off at about 30 minutes and went on and nailed our set as well, you know. After we did our set, they went and nailed theirs as well. It was a little bit fortuitous in we were special guests and we only played about hour and 10, hour and 15 minutes instead of the usual hour 45, 2 hours, you know. So he was still fresher than he would have been if we'd have done our full set. But it was still very much a hero moment, you know. He went out and he performed great. Everybody stood on the side of the stage and watched it.
Yeah, I mean the recording is available as a bootleg everywhere and it just sounds phenomenal. I mean, he really rough on the voice, though. Two sets in the same night, singing metal.
Yeah. He was younger then. He could handle it then.
Don't let him hear you say that. He'd be like, what? I'll do it today. I'll show you.
That's the trouble. Yeah.
we were both younger then. The tour starts in September. Of course, Pete Merluzzi's was the tour manager. Is Pete still with you?
No, he's got other irons in the fire at the moment, and I don't think he could afford. He's got a new business starting up, and I don't think he could afford the time away from that. So
I think a lot of people are doing that through this pandemic. You know, everybody that used to be on the road, they're realizing like, oh, you know what? I think I should have a backup plan.
That's true. That was his idea, you know. Nobody was going anywhere from a performance point of view. Yeah. And everybody, two or three other of the crew members, you know, got into other things, selling real estate and what have you, you know. Mm-hmm. And Pete was one of those. He found something else for himself to do and went ahead and...
Here's a question for you. Here's a super random question for you. Try and think at the top of your head. After 50 years of being in this band, how many bass techs have you gone through?
Oh, actually, not that many. Not that many. Most of the time, Glenn and myself used to share the tech anyway, seeing as we'd be both on stage left. And these days, very few things go wrong. Mm-hmm. So probably, let me think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, wow, probably about 7. That's 7.
That's not a bad number at all.
The guy that's been with me now, he's been with us for the last 3 or 4 tours.
You know, Jeremy, I'll say this. The bigger bands, the Metallicas, the Def Leppards, they're very loyal to their crew. And if you ask Metallica, for example, they probably only have had 2 or 3 because they find the guy they like and they stick with him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're blessed. We got a tremendous crew. We really do, you know. The Nucleus crew, of course. We get the same guys every tour if we possibly can. Of course, when we're not working, they go off and they work with other people, you know. Mm-hmm. But we're lucky. We treat them well. So when we go out on tour, they want to come back to us. And they're great. They really are. Our production manager, Martin Walker, he puts a great crew together. And Martin's been with us since the Ripper days, you know, so he's been with us for a long time.
Nice. Now, these are rescheduled dates that are coming up.
Yeah.
How confident are you today, August 26, 2021, that you're going to be able to get through the entire run? Because we see bands every day, The Cult, Garth Brooks, they're just canceling. Are you confident you're going to get through this? And So how do you stay safe? I mean, what's the plan? I mean, no backstage, no meet and greets, no...
I'm afraid it's going to be that, you know. I mean, we're all double jabbed and everything, so we're about as protected as we ever will be.
Right.
Unless something else comes out in the meantime, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's just that, be careful. And we're just going to have to keep our distance away from people. And if we go out in the evenings, try and keep a bubble together, you know. Mm-hmm. And try and limit the amount of other third parties you get to see. You know, it's a sad thing because all of us we've got friends and people that we see every time they come around, but this time around we're going to have to be a little bit careful, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Unless you just hang out with vaccinated people and then, hey, you're good. But, you know.
Yeah, you never know. You know, you go to one restaurant and you sit in the guy that coughs at you, and next thing you know.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, you know, KISS just, they started doing their meet and greets again, but they're doing them behind plexiglass. Like they're like whales at SeaWorld. It's kind of hilarious.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Kind of funny.
I was cracking up. I
saw the photo. Something, yeah.
Yeah, I saw the photo online. I'm like, guys, just cancel it. Like, you know, it's literally them just standing behind plexiglass. Like, it's such a funny visual.
It's a great visual.
It's not quite touchy feely there.
No, it's not a very personal interaction.
And I'll wrap up for my questions on this. You have, of course, Richie Faulkner that came in 2011. Andy Sneap has come in replacement. Talk to me about the impact of those two guitarists, because Richie really reinvigorated. And when we look at bands that change members, we always get the portion of fans that say, yeah, but bring back so-and-so. And yeah. Nobody says that with Richie. They just go, ooh, that guy's a mother. You know, they love him.
Yeah.
He's a tremendous talent. I think that's the main thing. He is a brilliant guitarist.
Yeah.
The other thing is a really genuinely lovely guy as well, you know.
Yeah.
He doesn't take himself too seriously. He doesn't pretend to be something that he isn't. He really is just a dream, really, from our point of view. And now he's been with us for over 10 years now. He's a member of the family. And he's a fixture, you know, for as long as we carry on. And we were extremely lucky to find him. And Andy, of course, Andy came in. One of the big reasons he came in, he just worked on Firepower. Mm-hmm. And when it was quite obvious that Glenn couldn't really do the whole tour, he, at that point, he could have stood up and done a show or two, but there was no way he could have done a grueling tour, you know, 5-6 shows a week. He wouldn't have been able to do that. And Andy's there, and he's ultimately familiar with the new record, you know. Mm-hmm. Of which we're playing 4, 5, even 6 songs off there. I think there's only one song we haven't played.
It's a great record.
No, I think we might have played all of them at one time or another. Yeah. So at least Andy's got a working idea of the songs. He knows the structure, basics, and what have you. So it was comparatively easy for him to fall into that. He's a great guitarist in his own right, of course.
Yeah,
and of course he's also a fan of the band, so he's familiar with the older stuff as well. You know, so he was in the right space at the right time, and he was perfect for the job.
Is he a member at this point, or is he still a producer who's just filling in, helping out?
At this time, he's helping out. Yeah, at this time, for which we're extremely grateful. You know.
Yeah.
Not that he ain't getting paid for it, because he is.
Well, I wouldn't think he's volunteering. Well, hey, listen, 50 heavy metal years of music comes out on October 15th. It's available now for pre-order wherever music is sold. And this box set is absolutely ginormous. It comes with Ross Halfen photos signed by each band member. The box set designed by longtime collaborator Mark Wilkinson. He even got a numbered British Steel metal razor blade in there, too. If that's not worth it on its own, I don't know what to tell you people. Memorabilia book. You got a replica of the British Steel tour programmees and all kinds of great stuff in there. 43 some CDs. Make sure you go pre-order this now. It's amazing. And maybe when you see them on the road, Ian will sign that through his little slot on the plexiglass for you.
Yeah, the end of the stick.
Yeah. Selfie stick. Put a Sharpie in
there. 2 meters long stick, yeah.
Well, there you go. Thank you, Ian.
All right, Ian. Okay. It was so great to chat. And yeah, cheers. We'll see you soon.
Okay, all the best. All the best. Cheers. Be safe.
Thank you.
Bye.
An all-new episode of the Jeremy White Podcast, Tuesday at noon. Available wherever you stream. Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now. Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.